From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Church.
Edge of the Mission.
The Yorktown.
San Francisco.
Coming up, a show about wildlife in the city. First, we'll visit the Altamont Wind Farm, a place that's good for energy, but bad for the birds.
Sometimes they will go, you know, right through the plane of the rotor, and that's really too close.
Then, we'll learn how to better coexist with the wild animals that live in our backyards.
The idea that this is my yard and no one else is allowed to use it, it's just kind of an archaic notion.
And we'll turn our attention to an animal that's well adapted to urban life, the often misunderstood pigeon.
If you want to brag on family values, I mean, pigeons have unbelievable family values.
The creatures among us, today on Cross Currents. We're going to start our wildlife show with a story about the clash between clean energy and our feathered friends. Since the 1970s, Californians have been trying to find ways to tap into renewable sources of power. Take the gusty winds that blow across the Altamont Pass, a low mountain range between the Central Valley and the Bay Area. By the mid-1980s, the area had become the country's biggest wind farm, and its field of wind turbines a symbol of environmentally friendly energy. Fast forward 30 years. Altamont is now a blight on the reputation of the burgeoning wind industry. Why? Because the turbines have killed over 100,000 birds, and possibly many more. KALW's Judy Silber takes us inside the controversy.
To a passing motorist, there's nothing terribly exciting about the dry, rolling hills off Highway 580 near Livermore. Until you get to the Altamont Pass. Then it's hard not to be impressed.
As we look out on the Altamont, we see propeller blades from turbines of all sizes rotating. And so one of the first impressions one gets is that it's a busy landscape.
Wildlife biologist Doug Bell is showing me around. He knows the Altamont intimately. Since 2005, he's carried out wildlife studies for the East Bay Regional Parks District. We stand at the crest of a hill and look out.
We have a pretty good wind blowing because the turbines are rotating, as you can see.
The newest models have sleek poles that rise 465 feet into the air. In contrast, older turbines are a hodgepodge of shorter structures, though they're all pretty tall by human standards.
It's quite a good day for soaring birds to be out here.
Throughout the day, we see soaring red-tailed hawks and golden eagles, and we hear meadowlarks sing. Bell says many more species live here, or stop over as they migrate.
Red-winged blackbird, tricolored blackbird, Brewer's blackbird, European starling, common raven, American crow.
The Altamont is dangerous for these winged creatures. The latest county report found an average of 4,600 birds killed each year, and some scientists like Bell believe the numbers are much higher. The older turbines are the greatest threat to birds. Some have lattice-like towers where birds can nest, and many are located in rows along ridges where birds soar.
Ooh, wow. See that activity going on? There's three birds now circling. There's one golden eagle and two red-tailed hawks. And they're actually getting... From here, it looks like they're close to the turbine.
I ask if it's too close. When Bell answers, it's with the tone of a parent who worries about his children.
I mean, sometimes they will go, you know, right through the plane of the rotor, and that's really too close. But yes, of course it is.
Bell and environmental groups like the California chapter of the Audubon Society are especially worried about the raptors that feed on prey hidden in the grasslands. They're at the top of the food chain, so if they go, it could disrupt the whole ecosystem. The county report suggests that an average of 900 raptors are killed each year, but other studies have placed the number closer to 2,000. We get in Bell's car. As we drive down a dirt road with wind turbines to our right and left, he scans the area for dead or wounded birds.
See anything?
No. But I'm always looking.
Every now and again, Bell rescues a wounded golden eagle. By law, he shouldn't have to, says Mike Lyons, who is director of public policy at Audubon, California.
The golden eagle is protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, as well as the Gold and Bald Eagle Protection Act. By protected, I mean that you're not supposed to kill them.
In 2005, Audubon sued Alameda County for issuing wind permits that kill so many birds. A settlement required a 50% reduction in bird mortality for four raptor species, including the golden eagle.
And the sense was, well, if we can do something about these particular birds to reduce the mortality for them, then we'll be benefiting all the other birds.
The companies removed the most harmful structures. They also agreed to turn off wind turbines for a few months a year. Some people think the 50% goal was achieved, and some don't. Regardless, environmental advocates say the Altamont needs an overhaul, that the older turbines should be replaced with updated, safer models.
It's been a black eye in the industry. We, you know, wherever we go, people have this image that the wind projects kill a lot of birds, and that's because of the headlines generated from the Altamont. So it's unfortunate.
Nancy Rader, executive director of the California Wind Association, says the Altamont makes the rest of the wind industry look bad. She says construction of new wind farms now requires compliance with strict environmental standards.
We're not going to deny too many eagles are being killed in the Altamont. We need to address it. We are addressing it. We're making sure it doesn't happen anywhere else. But let's get real. They're, you know, go after lead bullets. Go after the power industry. Go after the oil pits. Go after, you know, coal power plants. Go after housing developments that are destroying habitat. Stop picking on the wind industry, which is really not responsible for the big part of the problem.
Unless the county issues extensions that preserve the status quo, which is what Doug Bell worries about, that the situation will never change.
You see the big gray columns on the ground and the white propellers. So they're in the process of dismantling this wind farm.
Bell and I are at our last stop in the Altamont, a wind farm built in 1985 that now looks like a turbine graveyard. The East Bay Regional Parks District owns the land, just not its wind rights. Bell's hope is the district will also buy those and retire the land forever.
Hopefully, some of this landscape will be converted back to its natural curvatures, maybe get the pads removed and or buried, and with the turbines gone, that's a good thing.
If he had his way, the whole of the Altamont Pass would be as quiet as this. But the area generates about 500 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 200,000 homes. And so, even with the controversy, the wind farms are likely to stay. That leaves Bell scanning the skies for birds and counting the ones that don't survive. In the Altamont Pass, I'm Judy Silber for Cross Currents.
What do you think? Is the energy we get from wind worth the threat to birds' lives? We'd like to hear your take. Give us a call at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane. The clash between human and animal needs is not just happening in the skies. It's on the ground as well. As human populations grow, critters get displaced. Call it the original gentrification. More than 80% of Americans live in cities and suburbs, but that doesn't mean they have to be cut off from nature. That's according to author Ty Moses. Her new book, Zooburbia, is a call for people to live alongside their furry and winged friends. KALW's Holly Kernan spoke with Ty Moses about a new trend to grow urban gardens that sustain wildlife.
I live at the foot of the foothills of Oakland, and I noticed that every time I looked out my window or stepped out my back door, I would see one of my wild neighbors walking, scampering, or flying by. And I realized that I was seeing the same individual animals over and over again. The same buck with the twisted antler, the same giant mama raccoon, the same opossum with half a tail. And as I grew to know these animals as individuals, I grew more curious about them, not just about their natural histories, but about their life histories, their stories.
And this book is all about those stories. One of the stories that you tell, though, is how you kind of transformed your relationship with the urban wildlife, because when you first moved to Oakland, you wanted to plant a vegetable garden and you were kind of in conflict with the nature around you.
Right. Even though I've always loved animals, I really did have this fantasy of being a backyard farmer. And so I planted two giant raised beds of vegetables, and I got chickens and a home composter, and I was really living the dream. But I was in constant battle with the native wildlife that also was trying to eke out an existence on this same patch of land. And this relationship of conflict was really stressful and not much fun at all. And so after a while, I hung up my gardening gloves, or at least my vegetable gardening gloves, and I gave away my three chickens to a better home, and I tore out the raised beds, and I decided to garden for wildlife instead of against them.
And tell me what that means, to garden for wildlife.
You know, what that really means is to try to restore the land to its native plant habitat, because native plants are the foundation of life where animals and birds are concerned. Native plants provide food for all kinds of animals, wildlife, birds, bees, insects. An oak, for instance, one native oak supports more than 500 species of insects, and its acorns provide food for wild turkeys, deer, raccoons, and all kinds of other animals. And so simply by planting native plants around my yard and encouraging the ones that were already there, I found that I was welcoming animals in and providing food for birds as well.
And at the same time you're doing that, we, though, as we develop our cities and put in more concrete and take away more of the green spaces, we're displacing wildlife. And you're really kind of asking us to challenge the way that we look at urban nature, urban
right.
animals.
Right. I think urban habitat conservation is so important. And there are all kinds of there are cities around the country that are actually setting aside land for native animals, and they're planting native plants in their parks and in front of schools and businesses and even the freeway median strip. I mean, every place that you can put native plants, animals come.
And that's Ty Moses. She's the author of the new book, Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. What do you think are some of the biggest challenges of trying to change this mindset of how we interact with animals and to coexist more with the animals that are all around us, and the fact that we've kind of taken over their spaces, but they still have to adapt?
I think one of the biggest challenges is getting over the idea that our property is our property. You know, we are very fond of our fences and our gates and of declaring what's ours. I mean, we went to the moon and we put down a sign that said mine. So animals don't understand boundaries. They don't understand property lines. And I think the biggest difficulty is people just understanding that their gardens are someone else's homes. You know, animals are already living out there, and animals need homes just like we need homes. And so getting past the idea that this is my yard and no one else is allowed to use it, you know, it's just kind of an archaic notion. So I'm not advocating necessarily that we tear down every fence, but I do think that becoming a little bit more flexible and compassionate will benefit all of us, human and animal.
Are you interested in making your backyard wildlife friendly? For more information, visit our website at kalw.org. Just click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane.
There are some animals we might not want to welcome into our homes. Animals that have a bad reputation as dirty and disease-ridden. Like, let's say, the regular old city pigeon. But don't be so quick to judge, says KALW's Martina Castro. Martina's had a quiet obsession with pigeons since she first arrived in San Francisco. Recently, she decided it was time to figure out the story behind this maligned bird. She says what she found out is sure to make you gain respect for it, and yes, even admiration.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Pigeons, pecking pigeons, bathing pigeons, flying pigeons, walking, foraging, and scavenging the pigeons, doing everything. Pigeons cooing.
Okay, so I'm a little obsessed with pigeons. I'm not sure when it started exactly, but at some point, I realized I couldn't keep my eyes off of them. I take photos of them whenever I get the chance, making patterns in the sky as they play in the wind, huddling on telephone lines, or bathing in the dirty water that pools on the side of the road. I think it's fascinating to see how they survive alongside us in all of our filthy urban glory. The thing is, I don't know that much about pigeons.
And aren't they like, they're not even real birds, right?
So I asked around the newsroom to see what others know about them.
Pigeons, they're very smart.
I know that they are the rats of the sky.
They are the rats of the sky.
They are rats with wings.
Well, everyone calls them winged rats. Rats, pretty amazing also.
I don't know anything about them, but I've heard, you know, you hear that they're disease carriers.
I think people think they spread disease.
You can eat them. They're called squab when you eat them.
And the thing is that I really like birds. When I see urban birds, it really is calming, like a finch or like a, basically anything that isn't a pigeon.
You know how when a car leaves a puddle of oil and it rains, it gets those beautiful sort of colors, like a rainbow of colors? It's the same thing with pigeons. It's this kind of dirty, ugly city thing, but it has this weird spot of beauty. So I know that there's that and the poop.
Yeah, so I wanted to get beyond what people think and find someone who really knows about pigeons. And I found this person.
My name is Elizabeth Young, and I'm the founding director for Mikaku Pigeon and Dove Rescue.
I met her at San Francisco's Dolores Park.
Humans have done terrible injustices to pigeons and have very strong opinions that are, for the most part, inaccurate.
Young started the rescue back in 2007. At the time, she was volunteering with San Francisco's City Animal Shelter, and she saw that pigeons were dropped off but never adopted, meaning they were often euthanized. So she set out to find people to take the birds in. Young brought one of these rescues as a surprise guest to our meeting.
This is Mr. Margaret. Hello. Maybe get some of his little gruntings.
Mr. Margaret looks like an elegant, portly version of a white dove. But technically, he is
a king pigeon, bred for meat and sold as squab.
You can eat them. They're called squab.
Mr. Margaret somehow escaped the butcher and was found wandering around Golden Gate Park. Over the years, Young developed a network of volunteers to help her find foster homes for the birds she rescues, or to get them permanently adopted. And I should point out, the adoptable pigeons are ones like Mr. Margaret, totally domesticated. The ones we see out in the streets, those are called feral pigeons.
There are 300 wild species of pigeons and doves all over the world. The feral pigeons are descendants from rock pigeons that were brought over in the 1600s. From Europe and the Middle East and North Africa, where they're native.
Over time, some of these got away or were released, resulting in the breed that we now know as our city pigeon. And city pigeons are pretty much the same, no matter what city you're in, Chicago, New York, San Francisco. But the key point Young wants to make is this.
They're all here because of us.
Our fault. And in her mind, our responsibility. So that's why Young is pretty frustrated by all the negative myths out there about them.
This is kind of dirty, ugly city thing.
Pigeons love to be clean. Pigeons are crazy about bathing. They're very meticulous about their hygiene. So if you ever see a dirty pigeon, it's because they're living in a dirty environment.
I think people think they spread disease.
As far as disease risk, that is a big myth. Pigeons have amazing immune systems. They're actually really resistant to avian flu. They're also resistant to West Nile virus. So we are much more of a danger to their health than they are to ours.
But some myths are true, like this one.
Pigeons, they're very smart.
Pigeons have been rated up in the top for animal intelligence. They self-recognize in mirrors, which is something that children can't do until they're a certain age. They recognize human faces and remember them. They can abstract those human faces from a photo to an actual person, which is it's a concept that most animals can't process.
And then Young says something I've never heard before.
They're completely loyal. They mate for life, and they are totally devoted to their mate and their young. In fact, if you want to brag on family values, I mean, pigeons have unbelievable family values. And
so when you say mate for life, as in they choose one mate?
They do, and they're very deliberate, and they choose a mate, and they stick together through thick and thin. I've worked now directly with almost 600 pigeons and doves, and in these past 6 years, I've seen, I think, two divorces.
They're monogamous, too? As you can imagine, the more I hear about the pigeon, the more I fall in love with this humble little bird.
Okay, so you put it
there. You
like
go.
That.
Yeah. You go. You can just get them settled.
Okay.
Sort of reassure them a little bit.
At some point, Young hands over Mr. Margaret. She tells me to cradle him in one arm and hold him tight up against my chest. Pigeons like the security. He coos and eventually settles in.
I think it's really important. I think if our world was nice to a creature as common and humble as a pigeon, that it would be nice, it would like trickle up compassion. All they want to do is live.
In that way, the city pigeon isn't so different from the city person. Maybe if we take the time to appreciate them, to recognize their struggle and their beauty, we'll find something more in ourselves. For Cross Currents, I'm Martina Castro.
You can find a link to the Mika Koo Pigeon and Dove Rescue on our website, kalw.org. And if you're still unconvinced about the pigeon's power, well, just listen to this clip from a 2008 episode of Bob Dylan's satellite radio show, Theme Time Radio Hour, with a special appearance from Tom Waits.
I found some interesting facts about one of our fine feathered friends here, the passenger pigeon. The naturalist John James Audubon reported one flock is taking 3 days to pass and blocking out the sun during that period so that it would darken the noonday light as if obscured by an eclipse. And when they landed, they took up an area 40 miles long by 3 miles wide.
Now to the end of an era. San Francisco's Candlestick Park is no longer the official home of the 49ers. This weekend, they play their first game at Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara. So this week, we're going to be hearing people's Candlestick memories. We'll start with Caroline Hickson.
I had a friend whose dad owned a business, so he had season tickets in the front row just past first base. She would invite me to the day games when her parents were working, and we'd take the bus up to Candlestick, which was a pretty quick ride from Burlingame. Those were the days when they were on the run-up to the pennant that we got to go a lot. We went a lot in the summertime. They won the pennant, I think, in 62. And so that whole run-up with the famous song about the Giants and the Dodgers that Danny Kaye sang, that was all very familiar. Tom Haller, Stu Miller. Da, 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 da.
Cepeda runs the field of balls. So does Hiller. So does Miller. Miller hollers Hiller.
Hiller holler Miller.
Haller hollers Hiller. Points to Miller with his
and
fist.
And then he incorporated the names of every Dodger and Giant.
Orlando Cepeda.
And he had these little phrases of somebody batting and somebody hitting and somebody, hitting a fly or being out.
With a wham, bam, he hit a grand slam in the very first inning. But
and then he would talk about the person who fielded it and what they did and how they threw it.
Then fairly hits into a double play.
And then part of it, Leo DeRocher, Leo DeRocher, starts to wiggle and to twitch.
A signal? No, an itch.
Everybody knew that song then in San Francisco and L.A. It was quite the song. It was a big hit.
The catcher throws right from the solar plexus. At the bag, he beats the tag, that mighty little waif. And umpire Conlon cries, "You're out!" Ow.
Do you have memories of Candlestick Park?
Ow.
We want to hear them. Give us a call at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106.
Attendance 50,000. And what does O'Malley do? Charge! Bottom of the ninth.
And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Hanat Baba, Nina Gensler-Debs, Jenny Butler, Lisa Carmack, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Ted Muldoon, and Liza Veal. Cepeda runs the field of ball and Hilda Cup is first. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer is Sandhya Dirks. Our senior producers are Jen Chien and me, Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And because of your support, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. And now, back to the birds. Right now, you're hearing the group Odd Owl. The San Francisco band plays what they call progressive pop. Odd Owl will be performing at El Rio in San Francisco on Saturday at about 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.